drawing room over here.
Are you on the list? Oh, doesn't matter. Come on in. Here, have one of these.
Look up at the sky. Is that a galaxy? Is that a constellation? Or is it a scattering of astronaut fecal matter, some stray bolts and a bit of tin? Have you ever looked up at the sky and wondered what all those little lights were? It may be that some of them are not, in fact, stars and planets. They may be things of human origin. To explain in the drawing room this evening, Alice Gorman joins us. Alice is a space archaeologist, and her special subject, about which we will quiz her shortly, is space junk. Alice, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Define your terms. What exactly do we talk about when we talk about space junk?
There's an official definition of space junk, and it
That'll
is some
do.
Object in space which is not currently serving a useful purpose and won't do so in the foreseeable future. So it's basically something that, like a spacecraft or a satellite or a rocket body, that's not functional or not being used.
Mm.
It also refers to all those little fragments and little flecks of paint from the space shuttle, which is one that people often think of, and all of the bits in between. So it refers to whole spacecraft down to tiny, tiny little sub-millimeter particles. But it's an interesting definition because, at least for some of this stuff, it's fluid. It might not be working or usable right now, but at some point in the future, some piece of space junk might become a suitable material to use as a rocket fuel.
Right.
Or there might be some satellite, and this has happened, like some satellite that nobody's using and people think isn't working, and people send it some new software or go looking for it and find that it's still transmitting, and so it starts being used again. So it moves from that junk category into the category of stuff that we like, stuff we consider valuable, I guess.
Space hard rubbish collection. We should put this out and see what people pick up and use again.
Yes, exactly.
Do we have a firm idea of the quantity, just how much stuff is up there, unloved, whizzing around?
Well, we have some very good estimations, although there's a lot of fuzzy areas and black spots, and we need more information, more accurate information about what's up there. But according to the sort of most generally used estimations, so we have over 23,000 bits of stuff that are bigger than 10 centimetres in size, and millions that are smaller than that size. There's something like, I think, 4,000 functioning satellites. So these are the things that give us our meteorological weather maps, that we use for telecommunications, that we use for timing signals and navigation. So they're all the things your smartphone is hooking into all of the time. But biggest part of it, I guess, is the junk, is the stuff that's not being used anymore, whether it failed to get into its proper orbit or just ran out of fuel or some bit of it hit another piece of space junk and was damaged, or it exploded, you know.
Or it's all just kinds of astronaut reasons. Poop. I mean, who knows?
It's probably hard to get an exact figure on how much human biological material is up there in Earth orbit. So a lot of the International Space Station, they tend to return a lot of this rubbish to Earth. But some of the earlier space stations, like the USSR Mir space station, did used to eject human biological material into space. And I'm an archaeologist. For me, finding some of this stuff and seriously, it is. And there are people now who are saying, look, it'd be really interesting we could learn a lot about how the really fierce radiation in space affects human bodies by finding some of this material just seeing. I mean, you know, if your body is exposed to the space environment, it's already too late. But we could learn something that might help us plan for longer-term human survival. Like, people who are going to go to Mars are going to have a very long journey in very high radiation environments. So maybe this astronaut poop could actually give us information that
it
would
holds
help
secrets.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd have to get up there and capture it first, I guess, which is this part of the brief of, say, the International Space Station, that it collects bits and bobs from its environment and
oh, absolutely not. So the for the International Space Station,
you wish it
getting
was
close enough to this is one of the big problems here, like actually obtaining these samples. The International Space Station, though, has to absolutely keep as far away as possible from any of these objects. So anything moving at those speeds, so in we're talking about speeds of 7 or 8 kilometres a second.
And that's universal for anything in orbit, yeah? That's just the way
That's an average speed, so some things are moving faster, some things are moving slower. But at those speeds, a collision between things, you know, it's going to damage something. It might be those tiny, tiny submillimetre particles will cause a minor bit of damage, but cumulatively over time, that sort of might add up.
Potentially life-threatening for people inside something like a space station.
This is true. Like, you think of it, there's the analogy of the tin can, but, you know, puncture the tin can in a vacuum, effectively a vacuum, and that's not a good lookout for people who might be inside. So the International Space Station has to keep right away from any bit of space junk big enough to cause any damage to collide with it. So we can't rely on them to collect these samples for us.
They're too busy dodging them. But let's take this back a bit. I mean, we have established there's a lot of stuff up there. We're not quite sure how much or where, and also that it's potentially lethal to people up there in things like space stations. So what I'm now wondering is who's in charge of space traffic control? Who knows how to keep yourself safe from these whizzing bits of junk?
That's a really good term to use, because people are now talking about space traffic management, just like it were a busy, busy highway with cars going in all directions. So it's kind of at the moment a sort of joint international responsibility, I guess. So first of all, people have to collect information, data, about where all of this stuff is and predict its future movements. And that's something I think Australia is going to get more involved in. People may be aware that we have a newish space agency, and collecting this data and using it to feed into a system of creating a safer space environment is definitely a priority for Australia. So we have to find out what's up there. Yes. Then we have to find out what's likely to collide with other things.
Yep.
This is called a conjunction analysis. So you
because if it's in an orbit, it's in an orbit. Its path is predictable.
Yes and no. This is the tricky part. So it is predictable, but orbits are also, they're non-linear mathematics. So they're also very unpredictable. You can predict, but you might be wrong. And the key thing here is you have to watch. You have to watch this stuff all the time, because if your prediction is wrong, you've lost it. You've lost this piece of this space object that is so dangerous. So a lot of resources are needed to do this. So it's a kind of a joint international effort. There's a United Nations body called the Interagency Debris Committee. So it's kind of their job to coordinate things at the international level. But the bad thing is it's a national responsibility. Each country owns the material it launches, and that counts for private things as well. So they're responsible for that. They're also legally liable for any damage it might cause. So if you should ever, and I want to emphasise this hardly ever happens or has happened, if you ever get hit by a piece of space junk, or your cows in the paddock get hit and scared by space junk and don't produce high-quality milk that day, the launching state is technically liable for the damage you incur, so you can sue them.
Good to know. I have in front of me a book called Dr. Space Junk and the Universe. Its author is the woman you just heard, Alice Gorman. This is the Drawing Room here on Drive. Alice, what was the first bit of space junk?
The oldest bit is the Vanguard 1 satellite, which was launched in 1958. That's a US satellite. The earlier satellites have been pulled back. There's only a couple of them, have been pulled back into the Earth's atmosphere and burnt up. So the Vanguard 1 satellite doesn't work anymore.
Yep.
It's got no batteries left, no fuel, it's not transmitting, but it's still in orbit. So technically it is junk, but I make a different argument about this, I guess, again, because I'm an archaeologist. I look at it as heritage.
Nice.
So as it's 60 years old, it's the oldest thing that we've put in space. So it represents back in the 1950s, those aspirations that people had about our future life in space, which was very much, you know, the sort of Jetsons thing of we'd all have private little spacecraft and we'd go to work in our spacecraft and have pills for dinner and robots in the house to do all of the crap work.
We're getting there, Alice. We're getting there.
Well, you know, 60 years on, yes. These things are starting to become more possible. But it's like the space age is always in the future. It's never where we are right now. So I look at that Vanguard 1 satellite. It's very Cold War. So it was meant to show that the US was the primary explorer of space. It was meant to be the first satellite ever and so demonstrate that capitalism produced superior technology to communism.
What happened to Sputnik?
But, well, this is the problem, wasn't it? Sputnik beat it into space by several months. It became the first object in space.
Is it still there?
It isn't. So this is what makes Vanguard 1 so special. So at the time, everybody... Okay. Rubbished Vanguard 1, you know, it was a terrible satellite, it was a failure. But now it has a heritage significance.
Last satellite standing.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you tell me, and you've said this a few times, I'm an archaeologist, so I'm curious as to how an archaeologist, I would associate that word with holes in the ground and brushes and little trowels and the like, but involved in space, how does that work?
I know, it does kind of seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? But archaeology is actually about how humans engage with the material environment and with the artifacts and architecture that they create, with all of those material objects that human cultures produce. So while I don't get to dig holes in the ground, yes, which is one of the most satisfying things that archaeologists get to do, although it's only a small part of what we do. I'm interested in the same questions. I'm interested in what the places, and I count orbit as a place, the places and the objects and the relationships between them can tell us about human culture. It's just that it's in the present, it's right now. And people sometimes say to me, but, you know, hang on, you've got all the documents, you've got the plans and the images, you can talk to the people who were there. But this doesn't replace the information we get from those physical things. It augments it. It gives us even more to work with than most archaeologists do. And that, to me, is really exciting. I love talking to all the old aerospace engineers, particularly those who worked on Australian space programs like our first satellite, RESAT-1, in 1967, and the first Australian amateur satellite, Australis Oscar 5, in 1970. So it's amazing to talk to those people. But I'm interested in the places and the objects and what we can learn from looking at them, from their physicality, their materiality.
You must be itching to get out there.
I kind of am and I'm kind of not. So I would love to see Vanguard 1 from orbit, like to have a spaceship that matches its velocity. It would be amazing. And I think that would be a whole other question, like being in the physical presence of these objects, because now they're so far away. If we look for them, they're just dots of light in the sky. The thing about being in space, though, most astronauts suffer from space sickness, and sometimes it takes them a few days to get over this feeling. So it's like motion sickness.
Perpetually airsick.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there's vomiting that goes on.
Yeah, you're right. You know what will happen. You just contribute to the junk with your archaeological space vomit, you see. We don't want that.
I'm kind of conflicted. I'm not sure I'd enjoy the experience, but I kind of want to go there too.
Alice, thank you. There's so much to go through. I think we have barely scratched the infinite surface of space, however. Thank you so much for that. It's fascinating.
A pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you.
Alice Gorman has been with us, and her book is Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology and the Future. And you will find that in shops.